WLVQ. Brett was a radio guy. Loper was talking in that voice the other day. He was, here we are, the Extravaganza, 1987.
I actually watched a couple Loper videos yesterday.
Did you watch one with me? Was it good? I didn't watch it yet.
No, I think when we were looking, we were messing around with the 511 YouTube, me and Luke. And
is that your phone? Oh, yeah. That's going to buzz or something.
We're looking at just like some old ones. I was trying to see what his like biggest YouTube ones were just to see like what the interaction rates on. It was kind of crazy because he has like one video with like 200,000 views and there's like 5 comments. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like we have videos with like 50 views and then 50 comments. It just doesn't make it.
It's just a different format.
It's weird. But I think it was one where he gets like knocked out by a girl's butt or something. Not knocked out. She tries to knock him out with her ass or something like that.
Oh, it's like something old. Shock jock thing.
Yeah.
Are we ready?
Lawyer
talk off the record on the air. They do not teach you that in law school. We teach it right here, though, at Channel 511. Check out the episodes at lawyertalkpodcast.com or in all the socials. What is they don't teach you that in law school? Well, look, we've got lots of followers, lots of interactions. But if you don't know, what we're doing here is we're taking legal topics that I deal with every day in my practice. I do criminal defense work. And we are covering that from a real world scenario with two law students. Troy works for me, Bella, law student, both at the Capital University. I called it the Law and Graduate Center. I don't know what you guys call it. Law school. And, you know, you guys, I love this stuff because they teach you the academic stuff. And then in the real world, we have those scenarios. And that's what we cover. And today we're going to talk about
Brian Koberger.
Koberger. He always asks me, you ask me these things, like, we're going to talk about Koberger. I'm like, what? Who's Koberger? Well, Koberger's the kid out in, tell us the facts.
Idaho. He's the one that allegedly went into the house full of the girls, and I think he killed about 4 of them, like, slaughtered them with, like, a machete. It was, like, butcher more.
Yeah, I think it was 3 girls and 1 guy.
Yeah, and the picture that always stuck out to me was, if you looked from the outside of the house, you see the blood seeping in from the siding.
It was like, brutal. It was a brutal case. I remember watching that when it first happened.
Yeah.
And it seemed like an open and shut case. But this is the thing, you know, before we even dig into the topic of the day, which I think is some Fourth Amendment suppression issues, because we just had a suppression hearing in the case. But, when everybody sees this, the public sort of thinks, well, this is open and shut. This guy had to just plead guilty, lock him up, throw away the key, execute him, whatever it is. And all those things may be appropriate. Maybe. But it doesn't mean he's not entitled to a defense. He is. That's where I come in, right? I defend folks. And, you know, what do we defend against? Well, sometimes the defense isn't just guilty or not guilty. Sometimes we make sure that it's not too much, that the weight of the government has not been, is not unfairly brought upon a criminal suspect. And what would be unfair to Koberger? I don't know. This was a horrible case. If he did it, he's in bad shape, obviously. But we still have protections. And the idea of the criminal protections, the constitutional rights, are that we need to maintain them even in the worst of the cases, because when it is you, and I promise you, it could be you charged with something that you didn't do, you need those protections there. And one of those that we're talking about today is called the Fourth Amendment, which says the police can't search you without a warrant. So it protects us from search and seizure unless the police go get a warrant. Now, some quick Fourth Amendment. Have you guys had Crim Pro yet? Criminal procedure?
I'm in Crim Pro right now. We're like just getting into the Fourth Amendment. I think my class Friday or tomorrow, we're actually talking about this case. We're going to go over this. Yeah.
Perfect.
I'm taking it next semester, so not yet.
All right, so we'll go with Troy. So, by the way, we didn't introduce you. We have Troy Henriksen and Bella Mata, right?
Yes.
I want to make sure I said it correctly. So let's, Troy, tell us what's the first thing you learned about the Fourth Amendment in law school. I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah. Like I said, we haven't got totally to this yet. Fourth Amendment, you have a constitutional right to
be free from
unreasonable search or seizure without a warrant.
Okay. And then there's a huge but.
They need probable cause to be able
to get a warrant. But there's a bunch of exceptions. So,
that
the U.S. Supreme Court over the years has carved out. Now, if you read the Fourth Amendment, it says no searches and seizures without a warrant, no warrantless searches. Yet there are lots of warrantless searches that happen in our society. And then there's lots of things, and it says searches and seizures. And there are lots of things that are maybe defined as not searches and defined as either seizures or not seizures. So we just talked about or a good one to a good example of this is if you're pulled over on the side of the road and the police happen to have Fido in the back seat, and Fido is a trained drug sniff dog, and the police run the dog around your car and Fido jumps up on your on the trunk, and lo and behold, there happens to be a case full of cocaine in the trunk. The U.S. Supreme Court, I think the case was United States versus Place, says that's not a search. Why? Because they say so, right? Because a dog did it, right? So a dog is not a search. Police have to do the searching.
He's just a good boy.
He's just a good boy doing what he's trained to do. No big deal. Has no separate animus. Just wants to please his owners, which is the problem with dog sniff cases sometimes. But anyway, that's not a search. It feels like a search. It looks like a search. Seems like it should be a search, but it's not a search. And the idea of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is we have to get particular on what the definitions are. Now, back to exceptions. Not only are certain things not searches, certain situations don't require warrants. For instance, one of those situations is if you're pulled over in your car, the police can pull you over. They have to have some suspicion. You have to be doing something, maybe speeding. Maybe you're just swerving within your lanes, not even committing a traffic violation, and they pull you over. They have to have reasonable suspicion to do that. That's less than probable cause that would be required for a warrant, but still a reasonable suspicion. Why, pray tell, is that the case? Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that we still have, while we have an expectation of privacy in our car, it is less than that that we would expect in our homes. So look at the, it's like a sliding scale. It starts with this reasonable expectation of privacy. We have a reasonable expectation of privacy in our homes. That's like a man's home is his castle, a woman's home is her castle. You know, it's where we live. So we have an expectation of privacy there. So it's obvious you can't come in the house without a search warrant, but not always. So that's an easy one. A car, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, well, look, you're out in the public driving around. You're showing everybody what you got. You're out. You're demonstrating a lesser expectation of privacy. Agree or not, Supreme Court says so. That's it.
I think that's kind of crazy because I think the one we went over already was a phone booth. So there's an expectation of privacy in a phone booth, but not a car or less of one.
Well, what was the phone booth case?
The phone booth case was they put a wire in a phone booth.
Oh, a wiretap on a phone call.
It was in the phone booth. It was back in the day.
Like, right. So they put a surveillance, they put a recorder in a phone booth to listen to what people are saying. So when people go into a phone booth and close the door, the court has said, all right, you are demonstrating a reasonable expectation of privacy. It's relatively soundproof. You can have a phone call without other people eavesdropping. And, you know, that makes sense because any other phone call, you wouldn't expect the police to be listening in. So their wiretap law, I mean, that's a whole different.
Yeah. I just imagine the car same way. I opened the door,
I thought with the car, they can't go in the trunk, though, because that isn't exposed. Maybe the dog thing would be different if it sniffed it out, but I thought they wouldn't.
Okay.
They weren't allowed to.
So you were breaking down not only a car, so the police don't need a warrant to pull over your car if they have something called reasonable suspicion. And then the question is, what can they do when they get the car pulled over? Can they look inside the car? Can they look in the trunk? Can they look in the glove box? Or we can call it the boot. Like the old folks used to say in England, which is the trunk. Can they look underneath it with a camera or a mirror, rather? Those are all issues. And the first question is, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in those places? And the second is it a search to begin with? Now, there's some exception, and all of those things occur routinely, day in and day out. Like if you're driving down the road, you're on the road, like say on I-71 here in Ohio, and you see a car pulled over by a police car and there's like three other cops around, like there's something going on, you know, unless they're fixing something or there's an obvious breakdown, they're probably searching it for dope. You can almost be assured that these police don't have search warrants. So why? Because the Supreme Court has said we have a lesser expectation of privacy in our vehicles. Now the question is, what is required then as a result of that lesser expectation of privacy? In other words, what degree of suspicion is necessary? The lowest standard being reasonable suspicion. Above that, you have probable cause. the police or the U.S. Supreme Court has said you have to have probable cause to search closed containers in a car. And lo and behold, in your scenario, Bella, the dog jumped on the trunk, and that has been sufficient to give the police probable mm-hmm. cause to search inside the trunk. Short of that, though, they can't just open up the trunk. So that is one, those are exceptions to the search warrant requirement because we have a lesser expectation of privacy. And then the question is, still, what knowledge in the continuum of investigation do the police have to have in order to search things like the trunk or a suitcase in the car or your purse or your wallet? Those things are different. So back to the bigger picture, you have to have a search warrant unless exceptions apply. One is the automobile exception. Another might be, anybody got a guess?
Inevitable discovery, is that what it's called?
That's something different, but I like it.
A new automobile exception. You took the easy one, man. That's not fair.
The easiest one is still lingering out there. It's sitting right here on the table in front of you. Troy, can I search your car?
Consent.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Consent's another one.
The thing is, I hate watching all these clips of the consent ones where the guy's like, yeah, absolutely. And they're like, and then they find all the drugs and everything. I'm like, what? Like, why did you consent? Right. It just doesn't make any sense. And then, like, I understand there's like this little.
All right.
Maybe they thought it would look better.
Like, are you guys Star Wars geeks?
Never seen it, actually.
All right. I'm sort of a Star Wars geek because it came out when I was in my heyday of my young, impressionable youth. But there's something called a Jedi mind trick. It exists in the world, and police have been employing that tactic for years, long before and long after Star Wars. These aren't the droids you're looking for. You don't need to search my... The point is police ask questions in such a way that they get a yes. Happens all the time. I'd like you to step out of your car and perform some field sobriety tests.
Sure.
But they don't say, hey, look, Troy, you don't have to perform field sobriety tests, but I'm going to ask you to perform field sobriety tests, and if you say no, no big deal. They just ask, hey, look, anything, you got anything in the car I should be aware of? Well, yeah, not really. Care if I look around? No. Go ahead. And next thing you know, they find a brick of cocaine in your trunk. And if you said no, here's the paradox. Bella, you're pulled over and you happen to be a well-veiled cocaine dealer. And in your trunk, you've got a couple bricks of cocaine. Police pull you over and they have watched you maybe and they suspect you and they pull you over and they think we got her this time. She's got cocaine in the car, but they don't really know for sure and they don't have probable cause. And they pull you over and they say, they pull you over for speeding. And they say, we'd like to search the trunk of your car. Can we look in there? And you say, no. All right, here's the paradox. Everybody thinks, well, if I say no, then they're going to think that I've got something to hide in my car. And guess what? They think you've got something to hide in your car. Of course they do if you've said no. It doesn't mean it's always true. I happen to employ my rights when I can, although not to be a dick. It's like you're in that sort of, if I say no, they're going to be pissed. If I say yes, they're going to find something. Or even if I have nothing in my car, sometimes I would just
say, you just don't want to be rude.
No. It's human nature, right?
Yeah.
That's the Jedi mind trick. Mm-hmm. So Bella says no. The police immediately think that she's hiding something. And then so what? Guess what? They already thought you were hiding something. Otherwise, they wouldn't have asked. So still, you can exercise your constitutional rights. You don't have to consent. And what are they going to do? Well, you can go get a warrant. Go get a damn warrant. Now, why would you do that?
Or the dog.
Or they can bring a dog, and they might bring a dog. Now, there's a problem, because when they pulled your car over, they stopped your car, and there's a case. Have you had this one yet?
You can't extend the stop. Is that right?
Yeah, but before that, there's a case called Delaware versus Prowse that says a police stop motor vehicle is a significant intrusion that requires justification under the Fourth Amendment, meaning some reason to stop. You can't pull over cars. We're not Nazi Germany where they can just jackboot you over and say stop and search. So they got you stopped. Now they have to get down to business as reasonably quickly as they can. And that's what you were saying?
Yeah, like they can't extend the stop to wait for the dog or something like that. They have to like write a ticket. And then once the ticket's like handed over, it's pretty much the stop's over at that point.
And there's a couple cases, both came out of Ohio. One is called Robinette 1, 2, and 3. There's like three versions of Robinette. And then another one's called Wren, Wren. I think both came from Ohio. And Ohio makes it big again with constitutional screw ups. But, and what they're saying is they pulled Bella over for speeding. They got to get down to business and give you a ticket the way they normally would. They can't come back and kick back and say, what's going on? All the while they've radioed their buddy to get there with a dog as fast as possible. You're sitting detained, warrantlessly on the side of the road. And the suspicion for that has only been speeding. They can't extend that beyond what is necessary to get down to the business of dealing with the speeding stop. And this gets down to like stopwatches. You know, people say, well, 30 minutes to get a dog is sufficient. But, and I've raised this and sometimes to deaf ears, I think 1 second is too long if the police have no suspicion to extend the stop. So the cases that you guys are going to read that say 30 minutes was reasonable or an hour was reasonable, there's always some suspicion. So maybe the car smells like dope. Maybe the dog, or maybe not the dog yet, because we're waiting on the dog. Whatever it would be, maybe you look like you're furtive, or maybe they've watched you perform some dope. Whatever it is, they've got to have some justification to extend the stop. So without justification, it cannot be extended for 1 second longer than necessary. Now, if they smelled weed emanating from the trunk, they can say, all right, Bella, we're going to let you sit back here in the air conditioning in our cruiser for a while, and we're going to get a police dog out here, and that takes an hour. And if that's reasonable, that's reasonable. And then the dog hits and they search the car. That would be probable cause because the trunk smelled like weed, or at least that's the argument.
Well, she sells cocaine, so it'd be like, look like you just ate a bunch of powdered donuts or something. Like, yeah.
Look, if you sell cocaine, weed is like an appetizer.
Yeah.
But what if they got a tip from someone like Troy who said that I had coke in the trunk?
Informant tips. Aguilar, or no, what are the...
I thought we did something like that.
Yeah, informant tips. So that comes up a lot in search warrant cases where police go and they tell a judge who's going to issue a search warrant, hey, look, we got a tip from somebody, and they don't identify Troy as a confidential informant who has said that Bella deals cocaine, so we want a search warrant to search her trunk or whatever it would be. There's some rules about that, but the police have to put information in the search warrant that indicates you're reliable, and that could be based on prior experience. It could be based on even this experience, but several other things that you've told them have checked out, so therefore they think it's reliable. So informant tips are different. Now, there's also informant tips. You know, you're driving along. We'll make it his fault this time. So you're driving along and you see this idiot over here driving like a jackass, and he's all over the road. Maybe he's got White Castle bags he's tossing out at 2 a.m. as he stopped in the bars on the way home. And you say, hey, look, I got some guy in a white Toyota in front of me. He is all over the road. He threw out White Castles. We all know why you're eating White Castles, because you're drunk and you're trying to, you know, you're getting your fifth meal or whatever it is. And, you know, I want somebody to do something about it. So now the police go stop Troy's car. Then the question is, can they do that solely based on your tip? Ohio has some rules on this. If they can identify you, so that you give your name and phone number. If the police corroborate what they see, then those tips tend to be sufficient. So anyway, I don't know where we were, but we're talking about exceptions to the warrant requirement. So you don't always need a search warrant. And I guess we're supposed to talk about Koberger. So let's do that.
Okay. I mean, we've gone over like a long breakthrough of the Fourth Amendment. That's good. I'll start off with the facts of this suppression hearing. So, I mean, that's the biggest update in the case, is there was a suppression hearing.
A suppression hearing. Now, here's what that is. I mean, look, not everybody knows what that is.
Yep.
A suppression, they don't teach you that necessarily in law school. A suppression hearing is the defense has said, we don't believe you, government, your cops, conducted a lawful search. In fact, we hereby allege that search of my client's house, of his phone, of his car, of his stuff, whatever it is, violated the Fourth Amendment. And once the defense raises the specter of a Fourth Amendment violation, there's a burden shift. And by burden, it means now the government has the burden of proving to the satisfaction of the judge that there was not a Fourth Amendment violation. All we have to do is raise it. The government has to then disprove it. Mm. So, all right. So, and that happens by calling evidence, presenting testimony and witnesses at a hearing, which is called a suppression hearing. And you brought up something before called inevitable discovery, which really is an exception to the notion that any evidence found as a result of of a Fourth Amendment violation, a search that violated the Fourth Amendment, is suppressed, thrown out of court. This is when they got the evidence thrown out. You're talking about it was suppressed from use at trial. The judge says you're not allowed to use it. And here's my pet peeve. People would say, well, he won on a technicality. All right. It's only an amendment to the United States Constitution. It's a Fourth Amendment violation. That's hardly a technical problem. It's a constitutional problem. So it's not just a technicality, but a suppression hearing is a hearing where the judge has to decide, am I going to throw out the evidence based on a Fourth Amendment claim by the defense? All right. So now we've got that.
Yeah. So another thing, though, that was also done, we weren't allowed watching it, was a Franks hearing.
And Delaware versus Franks? Franks. So
Franks. Yeah, there was a Franks hearing, but we didn't get to watch it. They did a whole, there was a 3-day ordeal. The first day was with the media lawyers. And the argument was whether or not this was going to be a public hearing or not. And it's a different issue. But at the suppression hearing, these are the facts they went over that was on the video. At the scene of the crime, there was a sheath found.
A
sheath.
A knife sheath.
A knife sheath.
So something you would put your knife into store.
Yep. It was found there. There was DNA on it.
On the button of it or something. A very small piece.
Yeah. So of DNA. The cops took it. They ran it through their DNA database. It came back with no hits. So then they give it to the state police. Here we have the highway troopers. I don't know what they call them in Idaho. Gave it to them. That had no hits on their DNA either. So then they gave it to the FBI. What the FBI did is they created a profile off this DNA, and they used databases like Ancestry.com, some of those other private clients. They basically just made up a guy, put his DNA on there. They found a distant relative. And they're like, okay, this is the connection we're going to go. We want to get more specific. So they went to the house of his parents, where the parents put out the trash. The FBI worked with the garbage company to have a clean truck come grab the garbage. They met him at the end of the neighborhood, ran the DNA of the parents.
Parents of whom?
Parents of Koberger.
Okay.
So then that's how they figured out it was him.
So what happens is this. The police are at the scene of the crime initially.
Yep.
And they find evidence in the form of a sheath that would house a knife. And they run that through their, CSI lab, and they identify blood or DNA. Do we know what kind of DNA it was?
No.
It wasn't blood.
It was so epithelial DNA or some sort of contact DNA.
Yeah.
Meaning skin cells or sweat or something.
Yeah.
Then the police try to create a profile. And they do. They, in fact, do create a profile. So this goes off to a lab, and the lab has markers. I'm screwing up the DNA. We'll bring in a DNA expert one day. and think of them like numbers, like a set of numbers. And that set of numbers is unique to a person. And that is something, that set of numbers, they can compare to known sets of numbers that identify a person. And that's what they did. They created a profile. And when you say they can't identify whatever, they have the set of numbers, but they don't know whose numbers they are. They don't know if they're yours or mine. They might be able to identify from those numbers that it was a male. They might be able to identify a couple other things, but they don't know. And the reason they don't know is because Koberger, or whoever was the contributor or the source of the DNA, is not in the database. Then the police send it to the state lab, and apparently Koberger or nobody else that matches those numbers is in the state database. The state database folks then send it to the FBI. Now we're looking nationally to see if anybody else matches those numbers. And DNA sort of works this way. Again, I apologize to my experts who maybe are watching, but they start to compare certain matches of those numbers. Anybody who plays a lottery does this. You're like, well, I got four numbers out of that big, whatever it is. It almost sort of gets you there in DNA. So they match up, they look at Ancestry.com or any of those other places, and they find this mass database of people who might match these numbers. They run a computer statistical analysis, and the computer spits out this thing or some result that says, well, we don't have anybody exactly matching, but statistically speaking, we think that these people are distant relatives. Then that sends the police down that path, and they identify parents, and they start watching parents, and then they do a trash pull, and lo and behold, they find DNA that matches Koberger.
Mm.
Is that sort of what happens?
Yes, that's what happens. Yeah.
So they find DNA. They find Koberger's DNA. So now the police have Koberger's set of numbers.
Well, I guess compared to the set of numbers. I don't think they realized it was his DNA until they like swabbed his mouth when he was already arrested, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. So
but they had the parents, and that was, I mean, that's pretty close.
Yeah. So you're right. So what they have is they already had Koberger's. When did they get Koberger's DNA?
I don't think it was until after he was arrested.
Yeah.
All they had was
I don't understand about this fact pattern is why didn't the police just compare Koberger's DNA to the DNA they found on the knife?
I mean, that's a question for the police department.
I don't know the facts well enough to know that. Let's assume for whatever reason they didn't have Koberger or they didn't have it. But in Ohio, they would immediately have Koberger's DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And they could just say, look, you matched the DNA we found on the knife.
That would make a lot of sense to me.
So for some twist of facts, that doesn't happen here. But your question, so now there's a suppression hearing, and I imagine the suppression hearing is challenging
the
trash pull.
And how they got the DNA.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know. I think the defense was arguing that they haven't got all the evidence yet from forensic, and like the FBI was being like really weird about it. So they're trying to argue that maybe they used one of these databases that they probably shouldn't have, and they're trying to like cover it up in some way. They're trying to get that thrown out.
It was weird because they were saying the FBI documents were like all redacted. Like they're like, we'd have no idea like how they were even doing this, but all we know now is they used one of these databases that they said they would not use against their rules and policies. And then Ancestry.com and all of them say you can't use it either.
So let's say all that happened. All right. Mm-hmm. There's some Fourth Amendment issues that I can see why they're trying to claim it. I can also see why it's going to fail. The FBI accesses Ancestry.com and however many of those types of services are out there. And from there, they winnow this down to Koberger's parents, and that leads them to Koberger. And forget for a second why we don't know. They wouldn't have just compared Koberger to the sample, but they didn't for whatever reason. Koberger is challenging the FBI and police access to these databases as a Fourth Amendment issue. It is not a Fourth Amendment issue, and there's a couple reasons for it that we'll go back to where we started. The Fourth Amendment is premised upon somebody's reasonable expectation of privacy in the place or thing to be searched. Koberger has no expectation of privacy, reasonable or otherwise, in Ancestry.com. Now the question is there any other reason to throw out the evidence based on the police violating their own internal standards? Here's where, Abel, you brought this up earlier, with inevitable discovery, et cetera, but the exclusionary rule says as a prophylactic or preventative remedy for Fourth Amendment violations, the U.S. Supreme Court has said the penalty is you can't use the evidence. But that there has to be a Fourth Amendment violation for that to occur. What happened over here at Ancestry.com is not a Fourth Amendment violation, at least not anything that Koberger has standing. In other words, it didn't impact. He's got nothing there. He got no expectation of privacy. He can't argue that the police weren't allowed to search that because he didn't have an expectation of privacy to make that argument. And therefore, the exclusionary rule doesn't apply. So now the question is, should the evidence be thrown out for some other reason, a non-constitutional violation, because that's what this was. And, you know, the United States Attorney, the FBI, the local police, they all have their internal standards, but those don't always, and most of the time, do not trigger the exclusionary rule that gets the evidence thrown out. So in sum, Koberger's screwed.
Yeah, the judge, I think, that the line I relate to was he's like, the ancestry. I keep saying Ancestry.com. They said they don't know the exact database, but it was one of those.
Because it's blacked out somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think the line he said was like the terms and conditions of Ancestry.com are not in the Constitution. Like,
that's right.
It's
exactly what we're talking about.
He's like, they're in the wrong, but like, it's not a constitutional wrong. Like,
yeah,
and I was like,
it's shady. It's shifty. You know, nobody likes, and you know, we've run into this with things like cell phones where, is Apple going to give you the key to the kingdom? Is Apple going to make it easy for the cops to break into a phone or make it hard for the cops to break into a phone? Will they give them the software hacks or will they not? I mean, this has come up in in situations like that.
That was a big one during the Boston bombings, I think, mm-hmm. wasn't it? Like yeah. they like were trying to get through Apple, and like Apple was like
Apple wouldn't do it. Yeah, and they were like, yeah, and like, you know, and that's on Apple. So yeah. But I wouldn't have an expectation of privacy in data that my cell phone carrier possesses. Generally, now my phone's a different story. And certain data that they possess might be important, and there's some search warrants that are required there, but it's not always the case. Like this Ancestry.com information, I don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that. I won't send my DNA to some outside source because I don't trust anybody. Not that I've never committed crimes.
Neither will I.
I don't like it because I don't believe for a second that the government won't access and use it. Yeah. And then you would say, here's where let me put my foil hat on. You would say, why do you care if you never commit a crime? Because I don't trust the government. And why don't I trust the government? Because our country is founded on the notion that we have to keep our government in check. Mm. And the government is made up of people. And people are inherently subject to human flaws. Believe in your God or don't believe in your God, we all come with flaws. And if you think that that any one person can't be corrupt, fine, I'll give you that one. The next one in that guy's place will be corrupt. So the idea here is we don't have to have perfect cops because we can't have perfect cops. Nobody's perfect. We had one by my beliefs, but you know, that one, and it ain't in the police force. Mm-hmm. But what we can have are checks and balances that make sure that imperfection or corruption or mistakes get smoked out. And that's why I'm not going to just give my DNA because I don't trust that it won't be used in some way that's not corrupt.
I went home after this and told my parents that they're not allowed to do an Ancestry.com and we're not doing any of these database things. Yeah. I was freaked out. Yeah, I was like, this is insane.
And look, you guys live in a world that I would never live in. I mean, look, was I a saint when I was in high school and college? No, not even, or even law school, not at all. But I didn't videotape every damn thing I did, and I certainly didn't post anything that I did. You know, and now kids are doing this, and they don't realize because there's a conditioning that has happened that people think, well, I'll just send my DNA. That's awesome. It's neat. I'll share this. I'll post this. And you don't realize how that can be used. And even in a way that is not fair.
Yeah.
And there's no remedy for it.
It's just kind of crazy that people would, like, they would read those terms and conditions and be like, oh, well, the cops can't use this. And it's like,
only
yeah, they can,
so what is the remedy? My remedy is I would sue Ancestry.com and say, you screwed me. And they're going to be like, yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll even pay something, or maybe you've got some civil remedy, but the police are still going to prosecute you.
He could use that lawsuit for commissary, you know, he's going to be in jail.
Well, that's right. Use it for commissary. That's right. Yeah. So it just is, but just to bring it back home, the reason that it matters that people are posting these things, that people are sharing their DNA. Because what is happening? I mean, it will go. I won't give you the words, but what are people doing when they share, when they post, when they put their stuff out in public?
They're forfeiting their expectation of privacy.
Bingo! That's exactly what they're doing. They are telling everybody that I don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in this because I'm making it public.
Mm. Yeah.
I want to touch on one thing. It wasn't that big of an issue. The trash pull. Mm-hmm. I'm not like, are you familiar like at all
same
with
thing.
The like rules on this? Like,
I think what the judge said was like, as soon as your trash is on the street, it's technically like the city's at that point
but
to
why?
Collect. So it wasn't really a violation. I thought that's
but
what
why?
They said.
I mean, when we've talked about it in class, like it was like, imagine you put out like a basketball hoop or something on the curb. Somebody pulls up and grabs it. Like, oh, sorry. Basketball hoop's actually the bad example because some people put those on the curb. So like actually for people playing the street. But if I put a couch out on the curb, I think society, we, a reasonable person would interpret that I'm throwing that out.
Yeah,
is
like
free
it's
game.
No longer your property.
What
yeah.
are you giving up?
I'm giving up ownership.
You're giving up your reasonable expectation of privacy.
Yeah.
When you put something in the trash, you're sending it out to the curb. You're saying, I no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that bag of trash. It's fair game. The police can search it without a warrant. Not because it's one of the exceptions, but because the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. So these are the logical distinctions that matter. First question is, does the Fourth Amendment apply? Second question is, can the police search it without a search warrant? And Fourth Amendment applies when you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, not when you don't. And in both these scenarios, the DNA database that some of some third party's DNA. I mean, it's not even his DNA, so it's a third party. So there's two problems. One, he doesn't have standing. In other words, he's not in a position to go challenge this. And two, he doesn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So it's not a search at all. Mm-hmm. Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. And therefore, the exclusionary rule doesn't apply. And even if they did, even if the Fourth Amendment did apply, now the question becomes, is there some exception to the search warrant requirement?
I think what they were saying was from the DNA that they found that linked to the dad, that's when they got their search warrants and they were able to look through his apartment and his car and they found on his computer, like him buying the knife in question.
That's right. Okay, so here's what happened. This answers our question.
So I think it kind of led to
more. The police didn't know at the time who Koberger was. He hadn't been arrested yet.
No.
That's how they got to him. Mm-hmm. So based on the trash polls, based on the DNA evidence gets him to the parents. Parents gets him to the trash. Trash gets him to Koberger. The police then take all of that information, that constellation of facts, they put it in something called an affidavit. And an affidavit is a search warrant. And they take that affidavit to an independent magistrate, presumably, and they say, Judge, please give us a search warrant so we can search Koberger's house, this residence. And here's the reason we think that we have
probable cause
to have a search warrant. We found DNA. The DNA went to parents. We went to a trash. Clearly from the trash, we found DNA on items identified with Koberger, who owns this house, as a match to the DNA that we found at the scene. Therefore, we think there is a reasonable belief that there's going to be evidence at the house. And the magistrate said, yeah, I think that's reasonable. Here's your search warrant. Go forth and prosper. They go into Koberger's house. They find evidence that implicates him, including his DNA swab after he's arrested, probably. Or maybe they used all that evidence to get a search warrant for Koberger's DNA. That happens all the time.
When you arrest somebody, do you need a warrant to get their DNA, or is that just free chicken at that point?
They get a warrant. Okay. So this happens all the time for me. I get guys call all the time. I mean, maybe you've been around when this has happened, where somebody, a suspect in a rape case, say it's in a guy wakes up on Saturday morning, had a little too much to drink, and in his bed is another girl who had a little too much to drink. And then a week later, the police call and say, we're investigating a potential crime. We'd like to get your DNA. And, you know, the guy's thinking, oh, yeah, sure. I mean, whatever. I got nothing to hide. But then now the police have his DNA. People call me all the time, and I say, tell me to get a warrant. Why?
Because, I mean, now they have... You're in that database forever.
Well, more than that. So there's two things going on. First of all, the guy in bed, or sometimes it's the girl, it's happened to me both ways, should not make any statements. Do not admit to anything. And most people will admit, yeah, we had sex and it was consensual. You don't need to make any statements. You have a right to remain silent. Please exercise it. Secondly, you don't have to give DNA. And if you don't make any statements and you don't give DNA, the police have to get a warrant. Now, let's say they can get a warrant anyway. All right. I mean, that's probably true. The girl's saying, look, he raped me. I said no, and he said yes, and whatever it was. So now the police get a search warrant, and they take Troy's DNA. And in order to get that, though, they had to prepare an affidavit, put information to establish probable cause in that affidavit, and present it to a judge and get a search warrant. They sometimes screw that up. Sometimes there's not probable cause. Sometimes neither party in our fun fact of college heaven, remembers what happens. Happened all the time. People wake up and it's like, did I? I don't remember. Maybe. And look, this is why you shouldn't do these things. But if you have, it may not be obvious that there was sex, and it certainly may not be obvious that you're the one. And if the one side can't remember, and then they still have to prove that it was you. And DNA is the way they do that, and you've given it to them on a platter if you consent to it.
Mm-hmm. I just find this case really interesting because it seems like that's really all they have is like that little shred of DNA.
Yeah.
And because even when they were tracking his phone, it was like only in like a 13-mile radius. Like that's really doesn't put you at the scene.
The phone tracking, I think, is like a thing that people think is so much better. And when I started working for you, like I started realizing like on these phone things, I was like, well, we have them within like 15
sometimes,
miles.
Yeah. Sometimes. Look, but there's phone tracking. I mean, there's a case we're working on. And look at the evidence. Look at our report on that. I can prove where my client was Like, I can prove that he was at his house. I can prove that he was a half mile away. I can prove that he was at his job. I can prove that he was a police officer. I can prove he's in a police cruiser going around. And it's not just, so there's different types of phone tracking. One is called cell tower analysis. And in the old days, we used to look at them like a peace sign. So think of a peace sign with the three quadrants. And when this first emerged, the experts could put you within one of those quadrants mm-hmm. of the tower coverage. And then they had like per minute call data or something, or PCMD, that they could start to put you, they could start to narrow in on it. And now if you got your GPS activated or location services on your phone and the police get that handset, it's lights out, man. They'll put you right where you were. Mm-hmm. Then they do something now called geo-tracking. So if there's a crime in a vicinity, the police will go subpoena cell phone carriers and get information on every cell phone that was pinging in the area of the crime and start checking them off.
But I mean, you're right. They don't, I mean, that's all they have.
Yeah. They didn't find any DNA in his car of any of the victims.
Did Coburger make any statements?
No.
No, I don't think so.
It's okay. Kind of funny.
I just think
the pullover video is kind of funny. They think it's him. They pull him over in like Pennsylvania on the way home or something like that. And like, you should just see his face. He's with his dad. His dad's like, yeah, it's whatever. Like, I guess he might even got pulled over like three times, but you can just see it on his face. Like, he's just like,
he's sweating bullets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, but he doesn't say
anything.
But they
didn't find like the knife that he used or.
Yeah.
So weird. This, I understand what the defense lawyers are doing. I'd be doing the same thing. You're mounting a challenge to the sole piece of evidence that puts your client there. You know, he's got his DNA on the sheath of a knife that was used. The sheath that fits that was found at the scene. So presumably to the knife that was used to commit these murders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, this is, it's like the thinnest evidence, but it's also pretty solid.
Right.
Yeah.
But apparently they did find some other blood in the house that isn't identified yet, but it was a man's blood, but it wasn't his. So I guess the defense is arguing it could be another person.
Yeah. So look, when he's arrested, everybody thinks this guy's guilty. He did it, and it is what it is. But watch the OJ trial. Go back and watch some of this. And there's a new Netflix special on this too, which is sort of interesting. But, you know, there's a famous, I remember watching this live, and F. Lee Bailey, a famous lawyer at the time, now deceased, was sort of arguing some of this kind of stuff. And there was an objection by the prosecutor. And F. Lee Bailey says, "Judge, am I constrained by the prosecutor's theory, albeit erroneous, that there was only one assailant?" And, you know, the point is, take the police blinders off as a defense lawyer and start kicking stuff around. You know, if there's other guys' blood there, that's what we're going to drive a truck through to defend the case.
Yeah. And I think the defense kind of knew that the probable cause argument with like the DNA they found wasn't going to work. I think they just want to question literally everything. Because when you have someone on trial for maybe getting the death penalty, if you just put like enough doubt in the jury's mind, I don't know if they would.
Well, it's not even putting down the jury's mind. I mean, yes, that's sort of how we look at it. But the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Coburger did this. And they say they have to prove on each and every element of the charged offenses. So let's say it's murder. And that means you're taking one human life by another with malice aforethought, using the common law definitions that you guys know. The first element of any murder is the identification of the defendant, that he did it. And the police have to prove that. We know a murder happened. We know it was brutal. We know it was horrible. We know these people are dead. And we know there's four bodies or however many. I mean, it's awful. They still have to prove identity. They have to prove the suspect, the guy sitting at that table, is the one who did it. Sometimes there are eyewitness identification testimony. Sometimes it's DNA. Sometimes it's fingerprints. Sometimes it's some collage of circumstantial evidence, including cell phone location stuff. But they still have to prove identity. And you know, is there doubt about identity? Maybe. You know, Coburger is now going to be in a spot where his lawyers have to deal with the fact that that Coburger's DNA is on a knife sheath that is found at the crime scene. If I'm arguing the case and it is true that another man's DNA is there, I would say, judge or jury, they want me. And I get it. They're not going to actually say they want me. But what they're really saying is, there's no other reason for this man's DNA to be there unless he did the crime. And I would ask, why not them explain why this other guy's DNA is there?
Yeah.
Why? And you know, you might be thinking to yourself, well, the other guy's not. Well, I get it, but they're the ones that have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, not me.
I'm just thinking, like, that DNA could have been, like, on the knife, like, when it was at the store. Like, it could have been the worker or something. I
so
just feel like.
We're gonna bring in a DNA expert and do some
yeah, I find that
discussion
really
about this, because there's a study. I can't remember the case, but basically, there was a guy convicted of a crime and something similar, maybe as I forget where his DNA was found on coins or something. Anyway, they were able to track it back to an innocent transfer that until the technology emerged and studies emerged, the guy would have been just guilty as charged. So DNA is not always a slam dunk because it's gotten so sensitive. And by sensitive, I mean the DNA testing can identify DNA in the smallest fragments. And then it's not unlike COVID, they cycle it up and create more DNA from a little DNA and statistically try to get a profile. And then they match people up. Mm-hmm. So things like laundry in your household, there's been a study that we're relying on, a case we're working on, where if a family does its own laundry, the stepdad's DNA may be found on the stepdaughter's underwear innocently through transfer of laundry. And so what the study basically did is it went into a bunch of households where people are not accused of any crimes and started testing articles of clothing, and they found cross-contamination of DNA all over the place. And obviously the implication is, in our situation, where, all right, well, then how can you rule out laundry or innocent transfer in our case?
Yeah, that is interesting.
All right, well, that's enough of law school. They don't teach you that in law school. Or is it? Any other questions?
No, I think that's pretty much it. Koberger, I'll keep up on it, but I imagine.
Well, let's follow the Koberger case because if it is true,
I think
the
trial
is
set for August.
Maybe what we'll do is we'll do a daily commentary on the trial. But
I would love that.
Because what's going on here? If it is true that there, and I don't know all the facts. You guys know more of this than I do. I'm busy. I don't follow all the stuff. But if it is true that Koberger's DNA, the only evidence that links Koberger to the case is some general cell phone location stuff and a bit of his DNA on the sheath of a knife that was found at the scene.
Said the car was the same car they were looking for, but white Hondas.
It was
a seen leaving the scene. Did they find any blood in the Honda?
No.
I thought it was interesting. They had the expert come in and they were, I guess what happens is they had a vehicle expert. And they were like, what car is this? And he's like, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the footage. And they're like, well, how does the state say this is a white Hyundai when the
guy...
And
they messed up the year a few times. Like, there was something weird about the car, too.
Yeah. So this would be an interesting case to watch. Yeah. You know, it's not necessarily a slam dunk. We don't necessarily... They may not even have the right guy. Who knows? Maybe they do, but they still have to prove it. So that's where the rubber meets the road. And if it's true that it's a very circumstantial case on the single element of identity, it could get interesting. It's a lot like the OJ case that way, I guess. Yeah. So
I would say, though, if the sheath did get, I don't think it will get suppressed, but if it did, like, I don't think there would be a case.
The sheath can't get suppressed. Look, Koberger is going to claim that he's not the murderer and he was never there and the knife isn't his, he's got no reasonable expectation of privacy in the search of the sheath. He's got no reasonable expectation of privacy in the DNA database. He's got no reasonable expectation of privacy or standing for DNA database or parents' trash. And so it really comes down to whether the search warrant produced enough probable cause to search Koberger's house, where they got his DNA, and his DNA happened to match what was found on the sheath. Now the question becomes, so what? Does that mean he committed the crimes? And
I think they were also
maybe
arguing that, like, the database they used isn't reliable, so, like, to use that evidence in court is, like, setting a dangerous precedent.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Fair enough. That's an admissibility of evidence question. A little bit different. So the judge will inevitably rule this way. That goes to the weight, not the admissibility of the evidence. In other words, the defense can say, look, this is inherently unreliable because the way the database is kept doesn't meet any forensic standards whatsoever. And the jury's going to go right over their head. They're not going to buy it. I would almost... Challenging whether it's Koberger's DNA, I think that's a pretrial issue, not a trial issue. I think they're going to be hard pressed.
Yeah.
Unless they have an expert that can somehow mount a challenge on the comparison and the DNA testing, which maybe I don't know. Every now and then you get that.
I guess they have an unidentified witness they have that's yeah. supposed to testify. That'll yeah. be interesting. I wonder if it's the roommate, the one that lived.
Yeah, I imagine it would be. But like, from what everything I saw on her is like she couldn't really see or didn't think anything of it. She was like either tired, hungover or something. It was the yeah. middle of the night. She didn't think anything of the person.
But she said she like saw a figure. And then, like, just went back to bed.
Oh, an eyewitness at the scene.
Yeah. yeah. One
it was, like, roommate. The one roommate that survived.
Man. A horrible case. I mean, very, awful. So, look, I mean, we should, it's worth saying. We talk about these things, sort of, I call it clinically, and for legally speaking, but it's still tragic. You know, people died, and it's awful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people would ask me, how can I represent these horrible, awful people? Well, it's our job, and it's what we do. But it's not lost on me, I'm sure not you folks, that this was a horrible crime. It just is. But in our system, still have to prove it. All right. They don't teach you that in law school, at least not like the way we teach it here at lawyertalkpodcast.com. If you got a topic you want us to cover, or please comment on the Koberger stuff. I'm sure the collective out there knows more about the facts than we do, but we're going to keep following it. We're going to zero in on it, maybe do some stuff when it's actually going to trial. And that way we can share real-time thoughts. So anyway, this is Lawyer Talk Podcast, off the record, on the air. They don't teach you that in law school, at least not till next week.
I forgot to shout out this one girl during this. I forgot.